We are recording. This is Black Lunch Table New Orleans. Everybody at table four is going to introduce themselves. And then you guys are free, oh, I'm so sorry, are free to look through all the cards. Not all of them are blank.
I'm Jacques Morial.
Naomi Daughtery.
I'm Rebecca Reynolds. I teach art history at the University of New Orleans.
I'm Paul Wright.
I'm Nia Gibbs.
I'm Chloe Sinantian.
I'm Lena Sunday.
How have you contributed to hashtag Black Lives Matter? I've said the hashtag, but personally, I've attended meetings, not protests, but just in my social circle, meetups, and talks of organizing city-to-city connections. I haven't done anything as far as protesting, speaking out about certain issues or cases. Mm-hmm.
I'm not a huge fan, but I know when it was like the hashtag Black Lives Matter, one of the questions that came up was like, how have you, or if you have, on social media? Mm-hmm. Personally, no. I try to stay away from anything on social media because I don't want to get into arguments with people like via this. It's like, it's not even an argument, but like, I want to have a discussion or a conversation. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go back and forth where you don't hear the intonation in my voice, or where the cadence of the voice, or that it's not a it's a and I think it can get really, really charged when there are passionate issues, but you lose a lot if you're not
there
having a discussion.
Yeah, I agree. I don't talk at all about Black Lives Matter on social media, because I feel like a lot of people come from a standpoint where they really don't know and just join on the bandwagon. But I really learned in this residency alone that my artwork kind of speaks to that unconsciously already, just like by talking about it with Heather and everybody, like me being from the inner city and growing up in art here in the inner city, I'm already sharing that story. I'm already connected to that story unconsciously. So a recent thing that I did the New Orleans Jazz Market Black Lives Matter thing, where I submitted artwork for that. My best friend, she's a jazz vocalist, she sung for that. So it was great. It was a really positive event. And I mean, it's not like protesting on the street, but it's a different, as an artist, a different way to express.
Different medium
Yeah. So.
I went to the University of Missouri, so it was very interesting to when Black Lives Matter rolled out to be so near Ferguson. So I did a lot of campus organizing, and it was interesting, right? Because we at the University of Missouri, I think it was something like 30% of the student body is from St. Louis, right? So you had this huge population of people who were from Ferguson, on campus. And to see the way that the administration, graduated in 2015, the administration responded to people. It was I remember when the non-indictment came out, it was Thanksgiving break, and a lot of students did not feel like it was safe to go home. And our administration didn't really have didn't set anything up for them. Whereas for the international students, they'll extend the dorm room so that you can stay if you can't go home or Thanksgiving. But there was nothing in place. And we had been organizing on campus since the day that Michael Brown was killed. So it was interesting to do, while I was at Mizzou and everything that happened. I don't know if you all saw what happened with Mizzou recently. But it was interesting to, be a part of that kind of organizing and, going back and forth to Ferguson, and how that has shifted for me now being in New Orleans, where I'm, very much detached from organizing in that form, and what it also means to still be organizing in a way that I feel is more healing. Because I think about my time at Mizzou and how so much of my like brain space and my labor was still on raising white consciousness and like trying to get white consciousness to like see all these things and how laborious that was and how, you know, the amount of death threats that are accrued on like myself and like my Palestinian sister, and just it was so much, right? And then to like have a shift where like now my focus is definitely on like celebrating Black consciousness and that I'm a teacher, right? And
like great
and organizing in that form, and it's just been different. Like I think it's been very different, and to see, to be detached and like see what's still going on my campus and in Mizzou, and being from Chicago and see what's everything is helping with like BYP Chicago. It's like very interesting to like feel a part of that fabric, but in a very different place and like also in New Orleans, which is completely different.
Do you like the transition that you made?
It's so, I just think that this is so like incredibly healing. Like I think that the universe knew that I could not bend. I was so entrenched in organizing on Mizzou's campus, and it had gotten so personal, especially like when the death threat started to roll around, that I could not have been there a second longer, right? I think it like my mental health was already depreciating, and I think what I was talking to my roommates about, I think what I love about New Orleans that I don't see in a lot of places is, to me, there's such an intention behind creating healing spaces here. Right? So like you can go to Chicago, you will find a million places to organize. Will you find a place to heal? It won't be as accessible. And I think that that's what I really enjoyed about being in this space, is like being able to go to simple things like Black and Brown Bodies and yoga on Sundays, and like that being tangible and like seeing that. So definitely I love it. Like I feel like it's definitely a different space, a different place to heal, and I think there's also different organizing that comes from it being so healing of centuries.
I think it's really awesome to hear you say that, because I spent like the first 17 years of my life in Chicago.
Oh, so okay.
I kind of get that.
Yeah.
But I've been here now for 28 years, and mm-hmm. I'm in healthcare. Mm. And being here for so long, I feel like we really lack healing spaces. And so it's really cool to hear you say that you feel like there's, and there should be here. Like,
yeah.
This is such a unique place, and so many diverse people come here from so many different backgrounds, and I think it is a place that you can come to heal.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes it's lost.
Mm-hmm.
People get like into the newness of New Orleans and the cliche of New Orleans, and sometimes can get lost in that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really cool to see people that are new to the city and embracing the really cool parts of the city,
yeah.
The cool aspects of the city that go beyond just music and drinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's so much more here than that. Sorry, I just had to say that. I appreciate you saying that.
No, thank you.
Well, Black Lives Matter. So I haven't participated in any protests or anything like that. Sometimes it comes up with students. So I've had a student who was very involved in protests. I think it probably comes up more on a personal level, being from Charleston, South Carolina, and then just dealing with everything that happened with the massacre at the Emmanuel AME Church. And
yeah.
I was doing a lot of writing about that and about the question of how art relates to racial politics. And that sort of segued into here looking at the debates around the Confederate monuments.
Mm.
And I've been doing some writing about that as well.
Mm. Doing a plate stuff.
Yeah, I'll sneak up and grab plates if anybody wants to get rid of them. Because this is really important to the roundtable discussion.
Yes, yes. So I interviewed people pretty much on both sides, yes. And I also went to the city council hearing, the
one
where they passed
TV.
The ordinance to actually remove them.
Well, I mean, I guess I have some different thoughts about this, the monuments and how they relate to values around race and the economic order. I've always found them offensive, personally, and was involved with two previous efforts to consider removing them over the last 25 years. But I think that we missed a chance to have a substantive discussion about the neo-Confederate values that prevail in the city today, and that so much of the city thrives on. And I think, you know, had the issue been more thoughtfully managed, we might have been able to have an equitable discussion about it, and people would not have been so entrenched.
And charged?
Entrenched and charged about, you know, it's steel and stone, it's metal and stone. It's what they represent, but I mean, these neo-Confederate values really drive in this city to this day.
And I think, like you say, then I think about what happened, not just here, but like what's happening at Trump rallies, right? So what's happening at Trump rallies? So I watched a video of the protesters here who were like dragging out. And I think of like those people who were doing the dragging, like they live here. Like, you know, and the same thing in Chicago, like those people live there. Like those people are part of what create values in this city. So I think that's a really interesting point to illustrate.
Yeah. Well, I organized the protest last Friday before yesterday at the Trump rally, and well, they all kind of came together. What we tried to do is like encourage people to really organically, if they wanted to protest, if they had networks or they had specific issues or means or methods, we encouraged them to protest. And we met with the police beforehand and warned the NOPD not to arrest anyone because it would undermine their credibility.
Welcome to New Orleans, they listen so well. Sorry, sarcasm there.
Talking about the police?
Yeah.
Had a very interesting run-in to the police, my first very early encounters. Basically, bounty hunters came to our home because my girlfriend had been identified by her neighbor as fitting the description, which is, hold on to your seats, a black woman with braids.
That's like most of the population.
Exactly.
It's fine. But bounty hunters came to our home, and like it was very like a near-death experience.
Wow.
It's
surreal, it's sickly bizarre.
It was just so strange, and just like the history of it, and like, real quick, like her family is from Louisiana, and like her family, like generations ago, lived on Ferret and were living on Ferret. And like her family was a part of like a runaway generation who were like, so it was just like very like, and then the bounty hunters came for her. But then the police showed up and like, were attacking us. We called you. After 45 minutes, I was like, you know, we probably were gonna die. And you just showed up. And they were very like argumentative with us. Sorry to hear that interjection.
I 27 years, I have had so many bizarre experiences. Not that extreme, but I'm like, not. This is a total side note, but I witnessed a murder. I don't know that was how long, and it was in front of the Calliope housing project, and like no one. It was broad daylight, you know, middle of the day, kids running around everywhere, everybody scattered. Two people who did the shooting are like standing there. I go into a doctor's office. I'm like, hey, someone got shot. They're like, oh, that happens all the time. And I kind of just like walk back out to my car, got my cell phone, called the police. I'm talking to the woman on the 911 operator going like, he's running down the street, the gun in his hand, he's wearing this net. Well, we'll dispatch an officer as soon as he doesn't have the gun. And I'm like, excuse me? Like, aren't you, this, like, isn't that why we, like, where's the SWAT team?
I mean, y'all love to shoot people.
That. Like, I guess I didn't realize. Anyway, so, yeah. Like, now we've all.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, it's weird.
Yeah.
This would be a good segue. Discuss your personal experiences with microaggressive racism or institutional racism.
microaggressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, microaggressions. How would you define microaggressions?
They're kind of like very subtle
and like nuanced
forms of racism or sexism.
But they're backhanded in many ways.
Yeah.
But I'm going to tell the racist joke.
Right. Yeah.
Or something like saying, you speak very well.
Yeah, you're very articulate. Yeah, I love that.
Where it's like a compliment.
Do you all find issue with them being called microaggressions?
I do.
Well, I mean, I guess it's one of those things where, like, I've been in a situation like that, so if you're not in the situation and you're explaining it to someone else, you know, it can be either way. Because somebody can be like, oh, I don't see that being a thing. But in your eyes, I'm like, I'm sure it was a thing. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I feel like intuition. Like, you know. Don't let anybody else convince you that you missed that one. Like,
yeah.
No.
Yeah, it was interesting. But these words. When you bring up race, they make you seem like you're the racist.
Exactly.
And I'm like, yeah.
Exactly.
What?
I describe my experience living in Chelsea as microaggressive.
Yeah.
It's very macro. I lived in a building with an older French woman who's also an artist. We connected really well. Mm-hmm. But in the building, like, I clearly stood out. And whenever I was in the elevator, there was one man in particular. Like, every time he saw me, he was like, why? I say that too. Yeah. And a couple of times I've had a friend with me. Actually, the first time I met him, she was helping me move some boxes into my apartment. He didn't address me, he addressed her, my boyfriend. What do you mean?
Does it throw you off when people say that kind of stuff? I don't know if it's just me, but sometimes when I hear things, I'm like, I want to be like, have this great response or like snarky, ironic. Like suddenly, somehow or another, put it back on them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm always still like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, like you can't believe that it's actually happening. Yeah.
Like when that happens, where you're kind of like, what?
I actually, because he gave me his full name, I told my woman I was looking for, I also classed him.
Funny because
in certain
situations I feel like you just have to be bigger than that. Like you just have to take it for what it is and just move forward and be bigger than that. Because if you react, I've seen that happen, and you know, usually the person who was in the situation gets in trouble because he acted too aggressively, or you threw the first punch, or you cursed, or you spit at him, or anything like that. So I just try to move
forward.
Yeah.
Have any of y'all ever read that book, The Four Agreements?
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite books.
Yeah.
But the four agreements are always do your best, don't take things personally, be impeccable with your word, I can always get three out, and there's always the fourth one that I can't remember. Always do your best.
My mentor from college, like, loved this book.
At any rate, it's a great book, but don't take things personally. And, like, one of the big premises of the book is that any time someone's, like, don't believe anything that anybody says. So if someone's walking down the street, it's like, don't believe. Like it's all, you're an asshole. It's them. They're talking about them. Every time someone says
Yeah.
So as much as someone says you're an asshole, when someone says you're brilliant, don't believe that either. Like, just don't take things personally either way. I think I've taken a lot of things personally in my life, for better and for worse. Mm-hmm. So that's like a really good point to me about just kind of like letting some of that stuff like roll off, be a bigger person, and realizing it's not you.
Yeah.
It's them. Like, they are projecting something onto you.
actually found Tweed, and it's really good. As an ad, want women to enjoy life. Harassing young women doesn't subvert any of their existing optimism. Hashtag kindness, hashtag life is bigger than you.
Yeah,
that's great.
Kindness and compassion.
I'm just hoping you read it, like, on twinging.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if you all may have seen this, it was a study done by some researchers, I think, from Stanford, and it found that in terms of social media, that Louisiana was the most racially and gender prejudiced state in the country, and New Orleans was the fourth most racist.
Really?
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
Fourth most city in the country?
Yes, in terms of social media.
Oh.
So what the researchers did is they
took all the
social media
and
they searched some keywords, and I wasn't surprised at all.
I'm not either. I'm really not at all.
It's not just racism across ethnic lines, but like within racism.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't even say it was just racism.
Mm-hmm. Racism within
I'm thinking a lot about, like, because you said it was racial and what else?
Gender.
And I think about how I identify as queer. And before I moved here, never, like, was I read as queer, always. And, like, the harassment I've gotten from my students, and I've never come up to them.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said about you identify
as queer,
okay.
Right? And the harassment I've gotten from my students, walking down the street with my partner and being, like, called a man, like...
Really?
Yeah, and I lived in Missouri, you know, for 4 years, and Chicago's obviously different, but I think, like, the receptiveness that I've gotten in Louisiana has felt far more colder than anything.
That's weird, because I feel like...
Colder, yeah.
Because there's two different cultures.
Yeah.
It's very dominant, like,
no, that's what I'm saying, like...
I also think it's different for the black woman, though.
I've personally dealt with him. I'm from the inner city, and my fiance been together for 5 years. We walked through the inner city holding hands. I've never dealt with
him. I think it's different from the black woman.
Yeah. Because
I was having this conversation. Yeah.
My sexuality.
And we're both femme.
That's chilling.
Yeah.
I'm sorry you had to go through.
Yeah, because I was talking to my coworker who was like kind of saying the same thing. He was like, I'm a gay male, I've been here for a while.
Yeah.
I was like, I think partially it's been different because we're two women. Like, I think that, like, one is like the fetish that comes with it. Like, oftentimes, like, when we're stared at or charged, it's like definitely like we're being fetishized. And yeah, like, I think because bounce culture. At least, and this is my, like, analysis of just being here, I think that bounce culture, as far as sexuality, is masculine of center, right? So I think that, like, where is the space for the black woman in that? And I think of, like, even, like, I'm very new to New Orleans. Like, I still have not seen a space, like, for black queer women. Like, I've found those spaces for black men, but not for women.
Definitely. Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah.
I can definitely see that.
It's interesting that you mentioned about bounce culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're, because we're, like, a little more the same age or whatever, but I remember sort of when bounce started, like, before this wave.
Yeah,
now.
No, absolutely.
And I never thought a thing about that.
Yeah.
That's all. I didn't see sexuality. It's all, like, none of it. And I just kind of remember when it got, like, a little bit bigger again, being, like, sort of, I say snooty. I'm like, all these people getting on the bounce bandwagon. I mean, that's been around for such a long time.
Yeah.
And then it's, like, even evolved since then. And, you know, but I'll just say it, like, I'm older, obviously. So, things evolve over time. And it's, like, sometimes I feel, like, so in the dark that I miss so many things. I feel clueless. Not that I guess, maybe it's a good thing, because I'm not really that judgy, for lack of a better word. I moved here, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, in 88, that the population of Orleans Parish was, like, 87% black. Like, I'm like...
Isn't New Orleans still 60% black?
72%.
I just separated
there's
cards that are questions, and these cards are just information. Let's see,
yeah, there's some.
going to read them all, but there are 100,000 fewer African Americans living in New Orleans than there were 11 years ago.
Wow. How many were you?
100,000.
Wow, in 11 years?
Yeah, a lot of people that have to continue to just stay where they were.
And a lot of people, want to come back in Kansas too. It's too expensive to live here. The cost of living.
Shit, it's
getting expensive. 100,000.
100,000.
Wow.
How many do you think
since like statistics? The 2005 median income for Black families here was $23,000. In 2013, it was $25,000. The 2005 median income for white families was $49,000. And in 2013, it was $60,000.
That doesn't surprise me.
Damn, I'm not meeting any of them anymore.
And unemployment rates for Blacks in 2005 was 18.9%. For whites, it was 4.1%. And in 2013, it was for Blacks, it dropped down to 13.6%. And in 2013, for whites, it was 4.6%. And in 2011, just for Black men, unemployment was 52%. And for white men, it was 21%.
I just read that.
National media attention is centered on solitary confinement, prisoner abuse, death row, Angola prison. This is actually a discussion that discusses the local injustice. Injustice is in parentheses, justice system. Blacks in NOLA, 59%. Blacks in NOLA prison, 90%. We can discuss that one. I just wanted to read the last statistics in 2015.
So most of that information comes from our website called KatrinaTruth.com, KatrinaTruth.com, and it really challenges this narrative that government and the social and civic elite had tried to advance around the 10th anniversary of Katrina.
That they would like for you to believe.
Everything is so wonderful and it's a great recovery and all of this other nonsense.
I just want to make a quick comment, like this one, when I read this, the homicide statistics, and it said 2015, 164 shooting death-related deaths and 28 police involved shooting, I was like, wow, that's low. And I think that's a really crappy thing to say. But I mean, I was here in the 80s and 90s, and like, we had like a murder a day. Yeah. Literally, the day I witnessed a murder, that was the second one, and there were four in that day.
Yeah. In 94,
to be like this,
numb
to this, and be like, wow, that seems like it's really low. Like, but this is
I think
bad.
We should
like,
also talk about
the Lena, it's not. When you look at the population and per capita.
No, I know. But it's like the gut reaction when I'm looking at that. I was like, wow, like this is a bad statistic. I'm like, that's actually kind of good. We're like down. But like you said, per capita, we're not.
Like, I can remember the Superdome before it became the Mercedes-Benz Superdome.
I think something that you said that is very interesting is numbness. And I've been like really thinking about numbness a lot lately. I think like coming from Chicago, right? And like given the background that I had, right? I had like a very stereotypical, for lack of a better word, like tumultuous like childhood. And then going to college and then teaching my kids who had to make up like some kids, like families are quote unquote fit the norm mate, some are absolutely not. And I think what I've been struggling with is like how I've become so numb, right? And I think I had this realization yesterday, thank God for that day off, like the problem, like my like how it makes me an ineffective teacher when I am numb. And I think it's hard because like, you know, a lot of the kids, when they come to me with their things that like I've been through in my childhood and I've dealt with and I've healed from that, and now like I think there's a difference between numbness and acceptance. So it's like instead of accepting it, I've just kind of become numb to it. So they come to me and I'm like, Miss G, this thing happened, and like I'm numb to it now, and it bridges upon my ability to be my most genuine teacher. And I think like trying to force myself like out of the numbness into acceptance, so that
it's
I can
hard.
Yeah,
it's
very
painful.
Hard.
It's really,
it's really
painful.
Yeah.
And
it's like acceptance is a hard ass thing.
Me, obviously, and yeah. I use it the word frequently, but it's like self-protective mechanism that you use to function.
Yeah.
And when you get like a certain amount of personal experience happened to me 4 years ago. In blunt force trauma, in the sense of like multiple things like hitting you in life all at the same time, I could no longer be numb. Mm-hmm. There was absolutely, it couldn't be ignored, it couldn't be avoided, it couldn't have been glossed over, it like had to come out. And it's about awareness and acceptance, and I'm not there yet. Like, I'm 4 years into it, and it's like, I finally have some relief. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, cool. I can, you know, like, you're going through this tunnel of numbness, and you, like, realize that you've been numb to a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Because not only did you have to, like, no one gave you a mechanism to not be numb.
Which
no
I think one, goes like, back to saying, Black Lives like, Matter, too.
Being an effective teacher, too, mm-hmm. like you're saying. Like, we gotta give skills to now, so that you don't wake up one day when you're 38 going like, holy shit, what happened? Like, I believe this huge lie in my whole life. Mm-hmm. Like, thought this or thought that. Like, you're not, like, reality becomes so very different. Mm-hmm. And healing space in New Orleans, mm-hmm. it's like, absolutely, yeah.
I think it really goes back to Black Lives Matter, though, right? Because I think, like, you see, if you, like, talk about these movements that are happening, like, across the United States and, like, really across the world, where, like, people are organizing, people are having these lunch, like, tables, like, in the name of Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, like, just, like, we hear all the time, like, this shit ain't new. Like, people have been, like you said, 28 police shootings this year. That's low, right? But there's this idea of, like, right now, like, lately people have been coming out of that numbness. And that's why you see, like, these revolts and, like, you see these people fighting back and clapping back and talking back because, like, there's something that's happening that's, like, waking people out of, like, remembering that this does not have to be the norm.
Yeah, no, that's, I think that's really important for black male growing up from the inner city. Like, finding that healing ground. I was part of Yaya. I don't know if you guys know about Yaya, but that made me the artist I am today just because I had that place to go to after school every day. Mm-hmm. Keep telling me that, you know, you don't have to live a life where you don't feel like, you know, you don't want to go to school, you have to just smoke weed and hang out with your boys. You know what I mean? So finding those really healing grounds and crossing over from, like, I don't have to accept this is the only life for me, you know? Mm-hmm. So,
and it doesn't have to be as hard as some people want to make it.
No, like, definitely.
You don't have to accept that, but it's got to be this big fight, struggle, and challenge. Like, you actually have a choice.
Yeah,
like, it doesn't have to be hard. It doesn't have to be a challenge. It can be awesome. It can be fun. And it can be beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I feel like a lot of people aren't educated, especially where I'm from, aren't educated about those different paths. They just think
what
it's
part
that
of
one
New Orleans did you
I'm from Central City.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, it's changed so much, though. I was just there, like, for the Black Lives Matter thing, and I didn't even recognize the neighborhood.
Wow.
This that is actually crazy. Kind of goes into this one, but, like, not necessarily.
I'm loving your organizational skills.
Just to keep it going, this is about, like, media and politics, and this is about access and gentrification.
Gentrification is such a huge thing here right now, especially with more and more people coming in from other places. Mm-hmm. And just being here so long, it's so weird when you really think how much things have changed. I had a friend ask me, well, what was Magazine Street like in 1988? And I was like, I had to really, like, go back into my memory banks, and I'm like, wow, it was a dump.
Yeah.
Like, I can't really, like, parts of it were, like, a dump. Like, I'm not going to use any other word than it was a dump. Like, there were abandoned houses. It wasn't, like, necessarily ghetto or heavy or anything like that. It was just a dump. There were no coffee shops. There were no restaurants. There were no boutiques. Like, none of that was there. I remember, like, Tyler's. Like, it was where the Pure Bar was on Magazine Street. It was a killer, like, club that you just played and live music. But beyond that, there was, like, it was a dump.
I think this question, right? So discuss the recent influence of non-natives to New Orleans as it relates to housing prices and community. Like, something that, like, I live with two women of color, two other women of color, and it's like, we live on Ferret, like, in the middle of, like, right before you get to that, like, Napoleon area.
We're
on the other side, right? So we're, like, right before it gets, like, this new space where it's, like, where, like I said, some of my neighbors are like, that part, Napoleon is stretching towards Louisiana. Like, my neighbors, like, identified us as people who fit the description. But I think what we've been talking about so much is, like, what does it mean that we are all people of color transplants here, right? That we are not from New Orleans. That we're in this, like, we're in this community. We're teaching in this community. And, like, what is our place as, like, a black transplant? And, like, what does that mean? Like, what does a person of color gentrifier look like? Like, what is, you know, because there's not really discussion around that. Like, so yeah, I could say the same people. So many people go to Chicago, right?
Right.
I'm like, or sitting up in my hometown having this conversation, probably two blocks from where I went to school. And, like, you know, and that person could be from New Orleans.
Right.
And, like, and we're both POC people. And, like, in some place, we've both been displaced. But at the end of the the conversation, we're like both still transplants.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know.
I never thought about that. That's a good one.
What do you guys seek out in the city to try to adapt into the community?
Mm-hmm.
For shopping.
Oh, yeah. We don't shop too much. I think, like, we're very important on, like, supporting black-owned businesses and, like, people of color businesses and, like, spaces like this. I think, like, we all struggle. So Liana's from, she's Puerto Rican from New Jersey. Lizzie is black from Oakland, and I'm black from Chicago. So I think we're all from, like, very big cities and, like, understanding, like, what does it first mean to, like, live in the South? Which is different from, like, all of us. Like, I remember Lizzie came down here, and she's from Oakland, so she's used to, like, Planned Parenthood on every block, and she was like, I can't find a Planned Parenthood. I'm like, I just got out of Missouri, so I'm like, let me tell you about the South. Like, things are different. Yes, things are different here, but I think that we're very, like, trying to be mindful of understanding what harm we're doing from being here. You know what I mean? So I don't know if there's, like, a conversation to be had, but, like, what is the harm in us being here and, like, us being on Ferret with us, like, not this not being our home city?
Yeah, as a native, I mean, I don't know that you, I don't think of newcomers as doing harm by simply being here.
No.
But I do think that the sort of spatial nature of community here in New Orleans and the importance of neighborhoods to culture and identity and importance of public spaces to that, to cultural traditions, that a lot of that is at risk now because it's just too expensive. The cost of living is
I couldn't buy a house in New Orleans
yeah.
I had 14 years ago and if I sold my house
where would you live?
I'd move to Central City because it's the only place I could probably afford.
But then my
house.
Question
and
for you, my question for you then is, like, I'm from Chicago, so we want to talk about the price of living. We stay in a house that's $1,100. I can't go home, you know.
Like, so I think totally feel you
that's
on that.
Why I'm asking, like, I mean, what does it mean for a POC transplant here?
Right.
Well, like, trying to find new community.
You know, like rent went up in '88, $250.
Yeah, I'm surprised you don't have a card on that because the average rent has gone up 250% in the last 10 years.
Wow. And 10 years? If you found rent for 250%, like, you're, I don't know where you are. Yeah.
Affected the black community.
Here in New Orleans?
Well, yeah, like, I don't know if this is, like, there's no projects anymore.
Yeah, that's a good and a bad thing.
Doesn't this all go back to Katrina?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, doesn't this all go back to Katrina and the lack of dealing with Katrina?
Fixed income housing?
Primarily, yes. I would say 75%.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. There's projects anymore.
That's a good and a bad thing, I think.
There are, sort of. It's like, kind of like renamed everything.
Isn't the housing complex on Ferret projects though?
No, actually, like, not because the number of public housing units
Right to the left.
For
left.
Poor people.
And it's like, looks like separate houses.
No, like, wait, Naomi, okay.
And that was a big fight. I was actually involved in the litigation.
Like, it's
public policy making by litigation. So I was involved in that lawsuit to prevent them from tearing down the
wall.
Because they were supposed to replace it one for one.
That's interesting.
You know, it's scattered across the city, and they only replaced 10%.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of people who did live in public housing, who were working poor people, they absolutely cannot afford to live in the city now. They may be living in the West Bank.
Yeah, to the and Section 8 on the West Bank.
And so they live in the West Bank, so they have like an hour and a half to 2 hours more commuting time each day. And at the end of the week, that takes actually a complete shift of overtime from them. Or 2 hours that they could spend with their kids or with their family or caring for an elder in their family.
Not sleeping.
So it's really, you know, a double-barreled diabolical outcome. Mm.
I guess it is pros and cons to that.
I heard something about
it,
but I didn't get into it. There was something with
Big Frida,
Section 8 housing.
I saw that too.
What happened? Well, apparently she agreed to plead guilty because she was receiving Section 8 housing assistance. And apparently she admitted that she had fraudulently misstated her income.
Yeah.
I think
they went after her.
Not that it matters. I think they tried to make an example of her. It's like,
yes.
Come on. Suddenly one day you're like, made it, and you're like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I'm sorry if I forgot to like
change
tell
it.
You that, Jesus, you know what,
A,
I don't need your money, B, I don't like your money.
Yeah.
Well, not only that,
it's still your life.
Not only that, I'm rolling right now, but tomorrow I could be broke again.
Yeah,
exactly.
No, definitely.
Like, you know, and it's like, I give her like kudos and respect for handling it the way that she did.
Being
the bigger person.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like, come on, really?
And in a lot of other cases, they settle out as a civil matter. They just make you pay it back. They don't
That's what I thought. I was like, I feel like they're going to end up making her pay it back.
Well, she's got to pay it back.
Yeah.
She's also got to take
$100,000 fine or something.
A fine and a felony conviction.
Do you know? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Do you all know if there's any efforts for like reverse gentrification here?
Not really. I mean, there's an affordable housing initiative that is in its early stages, but on the public policy side, you know, there are state laws that prevent things like rent stabilization and rent control.
Because there are no renters' rights here, right?
No, it's a property. No, and we've tried every year to pass in Baton Rouge. State laws that give renters some rights, and this is just a southern state, you know, it's a property owner's state. So.
Do you guys want to discuss the privatization of public education? Literacy rates and access to college education.
Isn't that just an oxymoron the way you're the privatization of public education?
And prisons, because Can you detach the two?
Well, this is interesting, coming right after Wednesday's closure of a legislative session that did not solve the budget crisis and that threatens to close all of our public universities. It means that year after year, I have no idea if I'm going to have a job the next year. And then there's the whole charter school movement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a mess.
Well, and what's happened to UNO? Over the last 10 years, it's a crime against justice. It's really been eviscerated.
I don't know how we get away with it. Like, not just here, but like, it's happening everywhere.
That's the scary part.
Right. I'm like, how do we even get away with this as humans? Like, what are we doing to ourselves?
I mean, I guess, in New Orleans and in Louisiana, in a lot of ways, because of recent experience, it's so much more profound. It's happening everywhere, but it's so much more profound here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the privatization of public education, disarray of higher ed, public universities.
I think
over incarceration, criminal justice is worse here than almost anywhere.
It's like
and
you can't be ignored.
So
you can't push it under the rug.
Maybe we're the canary in a coal mine, and you know, the revolution might begin here. Maybe.
I think what's like interesting is I think like what you said is absolutely true. It is far disproportionately worse here, and like from an outsider, I feel like a lot of that has to do with Katrina. Cause like I'm watching Chicago, Rahm Emanuel closed 100 schools, right?
Did you go to public school?
Yes.
I used to live in Chicago.
Okay, Rahm Emanuel closed 100 schools down. 100. And basically what's like, he's trying to make it so that it has the same charter school model as New Orleans, right? So basically, like, taking it away from the... Sorry. It makes me very frustrated, and it's hard for me to get my words out. But he's basically, like, privatizing the entire system around education in New Orleans, I mean, in Chicago, in ways that, like, give principals rights to say that, like, you have to earn your chairs, right? There are charter schools in Chicago where kids don't have seats until they are behaviorally appropriate and can, like, earn the right to sit down. And it's interesting, right? Because, like, if I talk to my friends who are in education there, they're like, well, we're doing what places like New Orleans is doing, right? So I think it's interesting to, like, be, and I work for KIPP, which is, like, KIPP is technically national. Yes, KIPP, Kids in Prison Program. And I think about so many things, like, when we talk about privatization, and, like, my role as a teacher. Like, for one, I think the days that I feel like I have oppressed my kids the most are days in which I have felt most oppressed by my administrators.
Yeah.
Like, recently my principal got up and told our entire staff that we are not allowed to take our days off, that when we take our days off because we're sick, we are failing kids. And like, a 15-minute speech in which he basically shamed people for like taking a day off when we have one of the longest working days like in the nation, you know?
How is it productive to work in fear?
Mm-hmm. And I think it's just like what things have been like seem like it's legalized, right? And like what abuse have been legalized. Like when we move people away from being able to create a union. So like the reason there's like a fight back in Chicago still is like because you still have the ability to unionize. And like being in New Orleans where I feel cut off at the ankles. Like who can I talk to about KIPP when KIPP is so much bigger than me, you know?
If you go back to the privatization of public education for a minute, I really think everybody who is informed in New Orleans, it's our responsibility to inform people who aren't from here, because there's this false narrative about this, about how successful this experiment is, and we can't measure the results of this experiment.
You know, there hasn't been growth in 3 years.
You measure public education and education over time, and I think this false narrative, and we have other communities saying, well, we want to do it just like New Orleans. We need to say, wait a minute. We don't know if this shit is working.
But when it's corporate, like to your point, when it's corporate, it's not even us who are here spreading the false narrative. When Banana Republic, who is back and renewed, can go and tell their sister organization in Chicago that it's working, they all are coming from the same dome.
Like, I hear it all the time. I don't have kids in school here, but I hear it all the time. Oh, this is like so awesome and everything's great. And I'm going like, what Kool-Aid am I supposed to drink on this? Like, where am I supposed to get?
And God forbid you don't drink the Kool-Aid.
Right. Like, you know, where am I supposed to stand up on this? Because I don't have kids. And then there's like people like me who don't have kids are like, oh, it doesn't matter. And I'm going like, what do you mean it doesn't matter? Like, I'm 45. Like, I'm not going to be president, nor do I want to. Like, I'm going to be 60 when these people are like, these youth are out here. Like, wait a minute. It does matter.
Let me give you a data point. In 2011 or 12, there were more than 47,000 out-of-school suspensions in the public and charter school system in New Orleans Parish.
How many?
47,000.
I can believe that.
There were not even 47,000 students. So it's an average of more than one out-of-school suspension per student. And you know, whenever you hear about, you know, some violent crime, just notice the age of the victim and the suspect. and subtract 10 and a half. And think to yourself, what has this child or young adult experienced since Katrina?
Right.
And
that no one's addressing.
That we never addressed. And think about, you know, these young people in their most formative years, if they were displaced and returned and they came back and everybody was telling them that all of the social network and institutions that they relied on, their school was terrible, their teachers were incompetent, and they came back and all of the social networks that supported their families, their churches, their neighbors, all of that is just completely disintegrated. And that's that. And then their parents have to navigate this crazy market system of public education. And just so, I mean, just, I think that we really don't understand, you know, what's at risk with this experiment that's going on. And it's important for people who pay attention here to let people know, you know, when people ask you about it from other cities, or if you have friends or people in your networks, say, no, we're still struggling with this thing. It's not. And part of the problem with this experiment is we never had a consensus at the beginning about how to measure it, how to measure the outcomes of the experiment. And you said, no, we don't want a school system that is accountable to the public, to the citizens, the voters. We're going to take it over. We know how to do this. And to this day, most of the schools are not accountable in any way. I mean, they're either RSD, charters.
They know how to do something they've never done before.
Like, I'm thinking about how there's a school, I think it's Green,
Samuel Green.
Yeah, where they arrest you. If you have a fight, you're arrested.
Yeah.
And it's not middle school.
Yeah. I've seen some scary things in public schools. I went to many public schools here. Mm-hmm. It's either suspended or arrested. I guess, too, it's with the parents and stuff like that. They would call parents and come talk to their child. They beat the child in front of the whole class.
I mean, Rise just got down for beating kids.
Yeah, so it's...
Just recently.
I don't know. Like I said, it's a good and a bad thing. I just feel like the community doesn't have the knowledge to work with their own kids and work with the teacher because they're working nonstop. They don't have time to go sit in a class with their kids and really teach their kid discipline.
Because they live on the West Bank and are spending 2 hours commuting to work.
Yeah, it's a cycle.
Part of the problem with this experiment too is we don't have neighborhood schools anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the role of a school in a neighborhood, you know, and how a neighborhood really took equity and tried, they wanted their school to do well.
Yeah.
Even if you didn't have kids in the school. I mean, if
you went to that school football game.
You went to that football game, and when your neighborhood school band marched by the Mardi Gras parade, you would cheer.
No, definitely.
It's like pride. There was pride. Like the sense of community, I think, has changed so much around schools and just in general. Like cell phones, headsets, like there's not as much common ground anymore because we've all sort of shut ourselves off a little bit, like numbness, and kind of stay in our own little world. I mean, when I grew up, we knew everything.
Yeah, you had
if
to
If I picked a tomato from my neighbor's yard and came home with it, my mom was like, where'd you get that tomato? It was like, you're going over there, I'm going with you, you're apologizing to her, you're getting her tomato back. It's like, years ago, there was a little girl who lived next door to me, and she spray painted my house, and I was like, you know, like Oreo on it, and kind of chuckled.
And I think that brings, like, back to your point, which I think is, like, I felt. Because I think about a lot. So I asked we did this activity with my kids. And we were talking about, like, gender differences across institutions. And we did slavery, prison, and school. What I found so interesting is, like, how vocally my kids were admitting to how they do not respect their female teachers. Like, they just have lesser respect. And I was like, and that's been, I've been strong for 11, you know, little bitty thing, and like I teach freshmen. You know, freshmen are like, they're the chihuahuas, and they're just, they're there. And I was like, you know, what is it? What is it that you call respect? And it's like, well, Miss D, you gotta cuss at us more. You gotta yell at us more. Like, you gotta get loud with us. Like,
because
you can't.
That's how their parents.
Yeah, you can't. Right. You can't be Mr. Bryant and bang on the walls. And if you bang on the walls, we ain't gonna take it seriously. So I think like I'm up against this wall.
I was way more intimidated by my female teachers. Like anybody divinely feminine, I was like.
But it's not like, you know, and I think
it's not the same.
I'm up against this wall of like, I absolutely hate when I have to yell at these children. You know, and I was like telling them, like, when I have to yell at you to get your attention, it makes me feel dehumanized. Now I feel like a monster. Right now I feel like a direct product of the system. And I'm just like being oppressed and oppressing you, and none of us are getting our liberation. But it's like, but then that's the only thing y'all respond to, or unless I'm a white male from the East. Then I get all your respect. If I'm like from East, from Manchester, like,
is it
you
really
love, you know?
Respect them? Or is it something like that's what they
define. I think it's how they define. I think, I don't know. I think I would call it respect. I don't know if they know it's not respect, Joe, but like your ability to like not, like the violence that I get and against like the violence that these black like males get. Like my glass doors have been broken, and like, you know, I've been like hit by students, but like you wouldn't do that to Mr. Bryant because physically you fear him. So it's like, where, like, how do we, like
this? You nailed it. Physically fear him.
Mm-hmm. And then we talk about.
Respectful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the wrong kind.
Well, it's oppression too, right? Because we're talking about like these black males' bodies being like oppressed by this image of like you're angry and scary, but then privileging their oppression like over these female teachers. And back to your point, like what does it look like to have community systems in place that, you know, are somewhat aligning with discipline to reverse this, yeah.
I mean, they've been trying to do that since I was in middle school. Teacher-parent meetings, you know, it doesn't really, it's not really effective because parents are busy. They don't show up. And if it's like, if you even brought my parents to school, even for something remotely bad, it's bad on me. I'm getting my butt whips. My dad doesn't want to hear that. You know, he doesn't want to hear that. So now I'm getting whipped at home because of you. Now I'm taking my anger out on my teacher because you're getting me in trouble at home. And I don't want to see you every day. I'm going to just act out just because you got me in trouble.
And the way the school day is, you spend more time with me in that school than you do at home now.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Especially when a teacher is trying to intervene in the best interest of the student.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, well, I come from a family of teachers. My mother was a teacher, my grandmother's a teacher, aunts and uncles were teachers. But I think the relationship between teachers and students 20 or 30 years ago was completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that teachers probably had more license to intervene at school.
Mm-hmm.
And not necessarily involve the parents.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's maybe why it's so difficult, in addition to the two generations of
Do you think it's a product of the privatized, I've almost said prison system, school system, Freudian slip?
School to, the privatized school to prison pipeline?
Yes, basically. All the things.
I think that's part of it. But I also think that we're a second generation of parents in a lot of cases who never learned parenting from their parents.
Exactly.
They never learned parenting skills from their parents. And I think, unfortunately, I think you can trace this back to like the crack epidemic in the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
So the children and grandchildren of those people who were caught up in that and who were victims of the crack epidemic and became addicted, the sort of parenting traditions and standards and values that are passed on through families, in a lot of ways was interrupted and never resumed. So even though the parents of a seventh grader today might not be on crack, but they never learned the parenting.
They never learned how to.
They never learned the parenting skills from their parents and grandparents.
I mean, that makes sense. I was telling a parent how I had this student who was 16 and a freshman. I sat her at my desk because she was like being disruptive in class, and she ate my lunch out of my lunch bag at my desk.
Wow.
I called her mother and told her what happened. And her mother's first thing that came out of her mouth was, well, was she hungry? And I said, I'm sorry.
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry. But, like, she was in all-out seriousness. kids, you know what I mean? And like the response was like, not that like her child had stolen something from their teacher. It was like what was she hungry, and like what are you doing? Like, well, how, what was school lunch good today? And like, that's your problem.
That's like so many levels on there,
And when you talk about, like, I think I've been thinking a lot about, like, the privatization of it and, like, who the blame is getting taught. Like, I think so often when I, like, see discussions, it's like, that teacher, the teacher is a terrorist. But I'm like, the teacher is going accordance with the system.
That's, like, blame responsibility. Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, my administrators are running free in Freeland. You know what I mean? Like, a parent will be kicked to come and curse my ass out, but like, you will never see my principal, or you will never see CEO of Kit. But it's my fault. And then, what does that mean for me, who is like black, trying to teach black children? Now I'm pushed out of this space because I've been a victim to so much violence, and now you're gonna come straight out of Upper East College in New York and take my space, and you're gonna be given this quote unquote respect. You know, like, what does that mean?
That's like so many layers in there too.
Mm-hmm. There's so many different, I think, problems going on that there's really no way to address it too.
Like, yeah.
But they're so layered, and they're so like all happen simultaneously. It's like,
yeah.
Where do you start peeling the onion away? And there's like, you know, to get to the root, for example, but there's so many roots.
Community, so, it starts in a community. Like, where I'm from, school is optional. Like, you go to school, like, you're a nerd. Like, oh, you book smart.
And when
huh?
you say school, you mean
I mean
school,
high school.
Right, exactly.
I mean, not college,
like
high school.
I'm clarifying for those.
You're going to school every day? Oh, you must be smart. And I'm like, no, I go to school because my mom will keep my wife.
Right.
But,
like, yeah.
You know, it's
like, you just go.
It's an, like, there, it's like an option. Like, oh, you don't want to come hang out with me? No.
Where's your high school?
I went to McMaine. But I grew up in the third ward, so like around the Magnolia and the Melfamine project. So school was optional. Like,
I am
at Franklin, which are
like
exceptions, especially
NOCA.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely. When I went to NOCA, I felt so much more prideful in my education. It made me feel important.
That personal relationship with my teachers still has such an impact.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing. Like, I feel like you're put in a situation and you're forced to, like, negatively reinforce all of the crap that goes on in school. Mm-hmm. Whereas in that environment, you're put in a position where you can positively reinforce children, which is what anybody needs.
And then those teachers are getting more resources.
Break me down, fine. But if you're going to break me down, then show me how to pick it back up together. Or, like, focus something on, you know what, Lena, this was really good. Now, what you can do better is this. Or, you know what, like, you really messed up on this part. However you want to, like, whatever. I don't even care if you give me the positive or the negative first. If you cut me down in any way, or you give me some constructive criticism, or you just straight up criticize and judge me, please throw me a bone. Like, don't leave me hanging there going, like, again, don't think, take things personally. But come on, like, you don't know that when you're younger. You kind of take everything personally. Or you don't, you're totally numb because you don't know anything at all. Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah.
Oh boy. There is so much truth to that.
I'm also curious about, like, the correlation of school to prison here, right? With, like, both the Louisiana being ranked 49th in the country in education and then having the largest, like, prison populations. Like, what is that? What is the root? Like, what does it mean?
Because I'm in healthcare, so I kind of like have to, like, I think that affects everything here too. And we're like in dire straits in healthcare on this city, which
here. Like,
yeah. I mean, I'm here to learn.
Where were you born?
I was born in
Chile. Chile Hospital, baby.
So was it closed?
Well,
I wasn't. I was in Chile Hospital.
So I organized a lawsuit, that lawsuit too, to force them to reopen Charity Hospital because it was not damaged. And this was another thing, just like public education, that they wanted to move to a privatized model. And it was a big...
Which, by the way, isn't working.
Which, by the way, yeah. I mean, it was...
Charity Hospital, I think it's the oldest teaching hospital.
Second oldest teaching hospital.
Yeah. One of the... It was at one point the largest hospital with the largest number of beds, even though they weren't utilized in the country. I don't know if that, they probably have bigger hospitals now, but architecturally,
well, where was it?
It's still standing. It's okay.
Yeah,
on two legs.
It's a ghost.
It's that big building.
It's that big building that they say they see ghosts in all the time.
So the state actually claimed to FEMA that the building was destroyed 51%, and that. Absolutely was not.
You can still see that the equipment's still in there, like all the beds.
And actually, they could have reopened it 5 weeks after Katrina. General Honoré, the general who came down here, actually called up the governor and said, I cleaned up the hospital. It's clean, it's ready to reopen it.
Was O Street here before Katrina?
Ashner.
And Governor Blanco said, thank you, but we're not going to reopen that hospital.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And then a year and a half later, we sued him.
Yeah, because everyone went there.
Well, yeah, it was to it was actually to discourage working poor people from returning. I mean, that was clearly what they intended to do.
There were so many culturally cool things about New Orleans too. Like I remember, I worked at Charity for a year in mental health services, and I'd never worked in a hospital before. Period. I used to get like a little ticket every day so you could have lunch. And I always thought hospital cafeterias like gross, right? Oh my God, still to this day, the best gumbo I've ever had in my life came from Charity Hospital cafeteria. Some of the best food ever.
Yeah.
It's like he said, just, you know, like, no more people to work. Like, that rule, I mean, like, there was an entire population of people that no longer had jobs, and good jobs, you know, at that time.
And, you know, it's also like the privatization of public education. The objective was not to provide better health care or, you know, higher quality of health care. I mean, it was, you know, an economic sort of organization because they wanted to privatize it. You know, the objective with the privatization of public education wasn't necessarily to provide, you know, better education. I mean, it was all money driving it all.
Discuss historical legacies defining race and class unique to New Orleans. That's one thing I can never really explain about, like, what makes us so unique. I don't know.
I tried to explain the paperback test to my friend Paul Schwab.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about any of that when I moved to the South, obviously. Like, I grew up in an environment